Well, good to see everybody this evening, and always an honor and pleasure to moderate for you. To start off, I think Levi was skipped last week, and he's agreed to take the first question, so we'll start with him. Grant, did you have a question last week? Okay, so we'll just go straight over to the other side after Levi then. The title for this presentation or Bible study is Donkey Quest. So without further ado, let's begin. Question number one. What type of man was Saul? Why was searching for the donkey so important, and how far did they travel to find him?
So just in the context of this verse, we know that he's tall and handsome. He's from the tribe of Benjamin. Which I think we might get into that in later questions, but the tribe of Benjamin's had some relatively recent history where we read, I think it's Judges 20, we read about a lot of Benjamites getting murdered to where there was only 600 of them left. So that's why they're referred to as the smallest, but I think that might come up a little bit later. And he's also humble, at least at this point in time, because he's at the tribe of Benjamin, and later in the chapter you can see he's humble. So why was searching for the donkey so important? Just because donkeys are super important back in that time. There's like a ginormous quote on that Dad found about donkeys. But all you need to know is that they do a bunch of stuff in the ancient history. They carry a bunch of minerals and stuff like that. So they're super important.
Yeah, thank you. Whoever this guy is, Peter Mitchell, wrote an entire book about the donkey, which Dad found. I don't think we own a copy of this. He just took an excerpt from it. I'll read it here for you. In the ancient Near East, three themes stand out. The donkey's role as an indispensable vehicle for moving goods, both over short and long distances, most conspicuously in the trade of metal and textiles, as Levi said, minerals, between Assyria and Anatolia in the early 2nd millennium B.C., to lead associations as a prized riding animal. Religious significance is reflected in rituals governing the conclusion of treaties, celebration of festivals, and the curing of illnesses. So if you're thinking of a pagan nation, they would often use a donkey, among other things. Anyone else on question number one? Yeah, awesome.
Well, interesting things there about the donkey. Also, I think we might remember that when Jesus makes his triumphal entry into Jerusalem, he's riding on a donkey colt, so sign of peace as he's going in. He's not riding upon a white horse necessarily, but he's riding upon a donkey. So interesting tie-in. You have Israel's first king here. He's chasing after donkeys, I guess, and then you have the true king of the Jews, who's found a donkey, I guess, and riding upon it, or was given a donkey to ride upon. So I don't know what connection there is, but as far as a lesson to be learned, but donkey shows up in both texts.
Yeah, just piggyback off that a little bit, maybe. I mean, it's kind of considered a humble animal, right? And we're going to get into just Saul's demeanor in this chapter. It kind of mirrors that, as did Jesus's life and how he lived his. So, thank you. Anyone? Yeah, Dad?
Yeah, appreciate that. And, that Jesus riding on a donkey is part of the prediction Jacob gave in Genesis 49. Speaking of Shiloh, he said he will bind his donkey to the vine, and as Austin pointed out, his donkey's colt to the choice vine. So that was a prophetic thing about Christ riding on a donkey's colt. And also, was it Abimelech? I don't remember which one it was, but somebody had 70 sons who rode on 70 donkeys. So, there was quite a trade going on, I think. If he had 70 sons, he needed 70 donkeys. So they're valuable.
Well, very, very common, I guess you could say, in that day. Yeah, Dakota?
Yeah, another place would be in Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9. Where it says, there is a good and a little good. Behold, your king is coming to you. He is just and having salvation. Lowly and riding on a donkey, a colt the fold of a donkey. So, it's already been kind of alluded to. But I think kind of imagery that popped up in my brain when I was kind of reading about this is kind of like, in a sense, this is a king that's kind of wandering out in the wilderness, but not truly bringing the donkey under his reign, where Jesus has total control. He's definitely on the donkey. He didn't have to search it out. The donkey comes to him. fulfills that imagery of how all these earthly kings are going to be inadequate in every aspect and really fulfill the true kingship of Jesus.
Thank you. All right. Yeah, Bill.
Yeah, I was
hoping to get a Bill comment.
I like your fellow's comment about the searching for the donkeys. And one writer said that the Saul was led to the throne by donkeys, kind of indirectly. Mm-hmm. I thought that was kind of neat. You know, this family, Kish, you know, this was a wealthy family. This was an important, he was an important man. And later, as we'll see, I'm just from a Benjaminite, the smallest tribe of Benjamin, and my family is the worst. I don't know, there's a discrepancy here. I think he was downplaying his position, and I'm not so sure that was humility. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was fear. What was coming. But anyway, there's nothing said. We have quite a bit of little different things here, and there's nothing said about religion. Nothing said about their faith in God, Saul, or the family kids.
Yeah.
And I think maybe it was about 20 to 25 miles that they traveled for 3 days.
Yeah, we'll have a map up here in a little bit, just kind of like, you know, no one knows, but just the estimation of the length. I think that's conservative compared to what I've got. I got them traveling I'm like 40 or something miles like that. But yeah, we'll get to that in a little bit. What else was I going to say about the donkey? I just forgot. Anyone else before we move on? All right. Let's move on to question number 2. Oh, here it is. This is the map for you. So you can see, it's really hard to see actually, but 5 kilometers is this little space, 5 miles is this space. So, you know, about that distance, about 5 miles. So ring around the rosy. And, I don't know, we came up like 40, 45 or something. Nobody knows, but it's just fun to speculate, I guess. All right, question number 2. And this will be for Trace, if you want it. Where is the land of Zuth? Why did they want to go to see the men of God at this time? Could this attitude towards God and prophecy be a sign of how Saul would ultimately treat God later on during his reign? And is there any difference between a prophet, a man of God, and a seer?
So for the first part, I mean, it seems like everything kind of happened in a close proximity of itself. Mm-hmm. So the land of Zoph, I can't really pinpoint exactly where it is, but it's, like I said, it's in that proximity.
Yeah.
Why did they go to see a man of God at this time? Well, it's kind of a twofold reason. One for the donkeys, and one, you know, for Saul, you know, for God's providence, and Saul to be king. And for C, could this attitude towards God and prophecy be a sign of how Saul would ultimately treat God later on during the reign? The way it's worded, I would say not so much. I'd say he kind of diverts from his righteous path and goes the other direction for sure. Because once he, you know, we'll know a lot more in the future. But once he gets, you know, word that David is going to be the king, that really sets him in a bad mindset.
Yeah.
Is there any difference between a prophet, a man of God, and a seer? I couldn't see a difference, really. They all seem like the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the idea of seer seemed kind of, I don't know, more of a bad sign for a prophet. Mm-hmm. Kind of seemed like more something that was just kind of something that was being said of other people around that area. But I don't know. I think I'm more comfortable with the prophet, the man of God aspect of it. Yeah,
appreciate that. One thing Dad brought up in our study at home was in the West, we kind of like to be very specific with definitions and names and things. When you're dealing with things like this, you know, in the old world, a lot of things were interchangeable. Language meant a lot, but, there was also kind of like an inequality to all of it. So all these things are kind of the same thing, and in verse 9, I mean, it'll tell us basically right there, come, let's go see a seer, for he who is called is he who is now called a prophet was formerly called a seer. So, just some interesting, I'd love to see the Hebrew on that. I didn't actually delve into that. Anyone have any comments on that? Just something about question, let's see, it was C, yeah. I struggled a little bit with this one, just in like the wording of it, understanding what it is you were getting at, Austin. I agree with what Trey said, but I also kind of thought of how Saul is approaching this whole situation, and he's freaking out about his donkeys, and he doesn't know what to do, and it's only then that he's like, oh, I need a man of God. I need to go. I'm not sure if that's the angle you took with it, but I need to go see a man of God because I'm in trouble. And he wasn't, maybe he wasn't relying on God as much normally, right? That's just speculation, as Bill alluded to, not too much religious language or saying that he was a man of God in his introduction. Austin, do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, so I think it's going to be interesting. It's already been interesting. As we go through this narrative, kind of our perspective on people. So like when we were talking about Eli, we had a lot of comments about, what kind of person he was, and we talked a lot about Samuel, and I think we'll still have several more thoughts on the character of Samuel. My initial thoughts right now on Saul are pretty negative. Because what I was thinking about this, kind of like what you just said, they've been wandering this whole time. Like you said, you showed the map there, which I think is probably pretty accurate. It talks about the hill country of Ephraim, which we know is quite a ways from there in Benjamin. And finally, after all that, he's like, well, and it's not even him. Isn't it the servant that says, hey, there's a man of God over here in this particular city. Why don't we just go see if he can show us where our donkeys are. He's not thinking about God. He's not praising God or offering anything to him. And he's like, well, we don't have anything to give him. We got to bring him something. So is that what that is?
A shekel right there.
Shekel. So he kind of treats God like a good luck charm or like a magic eight ball type of thing.
Transactional.
That's a good word. Because I was thinking about later on in his reign when God has abandoned him, what's he still coming to God for? Not, oh, I need to repent. Oh, I need to change my life. No, he goes to the witch of Endor to raise up Samuel again to see if he's going to win the battle. And it seems like as we go through, I think we're going to see that Saul treats God very transactionally. If I win, I give him a sacrifice. Illegally, or not according to the law, we might say. I think it talks about that in 12 or 13. With the Amalekites. Oh, no, I know what he said, but I kept back these things so we could sacrifice them to God, you see. Very transactional in his way that he looks at God. Even though God is going to do a lot for him, as we're going to notice. But I think this is kind of a harbinger of who Saul is as a man.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll get into the discussion of what Samuel might be thinking of Saul, right, and his character as we go on here. But yeah, just a little bit on this before we move on. This was something Dad found. It was a shekel of silver at was it some museum, or something like that.
Before there's a
better quality image.
That's
that right there. Oh yeah, the 1 million quarter shekel. So this was valued at $1 million. It made its way back to Israel from some kind of a law dispute that happened. But great Jewish revolt in 69, where it dates to. And that's kind of gives you an idea of what we're talking about here. The servant said, we'll give to the man of God. Anyone else before we move on? Yeah, Bill?
Yeah, that's a quarter shekel. Keep that in mind. That's not a shekel. That's a quarter shekel. Let's see. I was looking at the also I appreciated the comment about it was the servant that thought to inquire of God. It was the servant that said that the man of God was honorable, verse 6, and believed the man of God would be able to help them. This was all the servant, to kind of the Austin's point. This wasn't Saul. And I looked up seer. This is 1 Samuel chapter 9, verse 9. This is the first time it's used. Amos chapter 7 and verse 12 is the last time it's used. And through that range in 22 verses, it's been used 22 times. So I did the same thing with prophet. The prophet was used in Genesis chapter 20. So Trey's prophet's been around a lot longer than seer, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Oh, and then, let's see. This is from Clark. A seer and a prophet were the same in most cases, only with this difference. The seer was always a prophet, but the prophet was not always a seer.
What did you go into detail? Like what other?
No, I did. That's all I had.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Well, maybe we could have a more in-depth discussion sometime on the intricacies of each role. Yeah, Dad.
Go back to the map.
Yeah.
Just one last thing I thought was worth pointing out, and it's too small to see, but Zoph there, it mentions there's two Zoths in the Bible. One is this geographic location. The other is, can you read it from where you're at?
You're talking about the Wikipedia article?
Where it says, it says, according to the Book of Chronicles, he was a Levite.
Yeah, Levite. Oh, wow, there's like two pixels.
And, okay, so.
In fact, not mentioned in the Book of Samuel, he was the ancestor of Elkanah and Samuel.
Right.
Called Zephaniah in a parallel passage.
Right, okay, so the point is that Zoph is unknown as a city or a place, but Zoph was an ancestor of Samuel and Elkanah. And so it seems like over the years that Samuel's been a prophet, they, in order to show respect to Samuel, they have renamed the area of Ramah the land of Zoph. And so it's kind of cool. I think that's a neat little, because nobody knows where Zoph was. It's not a city. And so when they say they're coming back to Zoph, what they're saying is they're coming back to the territory of Samuel, where Samuel's at.
So just to go back to this, you're saying around
that area
this geological area.
That's the land of Zoph.
Okay, cool. All right, thank you. Anyone else on question two, the various questions of this question, before we move on? All right, let's go to question number three. This will be for you, Malin, if you want it. What can these passages tell us about the state of spirituality in the land of Israel at this time?
Yeah, so it kind of appears to me, at least, that maybe the people here didn't know too much about serving God. But they did know Samuel, and so they kind of left it to him. So I guess they relied on him to kind of be their, almost like their leader. But you know, we see from these verses that you know they knew of the seer, and so I guess I kind of imply that maybe they knew that he was a righteous man. Maybe I'm reading too much into that. But then they also knew his routine as well. That he would go up to the high place, and of course that he would bless the sacrifice, the food, and then so they kind of waited for him to do that. So that was kind of a little torn, but that's my two cents.
Yeah, no, I think that's perfect given you know what we're given. So we were talking in our study at home. You know, they see him. They probably knew him. As the prophet, right, he's traveling around these various areas, and they're seeing him pretty often. They knew what he was up to. One thing we did talk about is the state of the spirituality. We don't really know how much paganism is going on right now in this area, right? Like, are they worshiping Baal? Do they have idols in their houses? We talked about that there. We obviously don't really know. But one thing's for certain that they do have a sense of respect for Samuel and what he does. Any other comments on this question? Yeah, Austin.
Kaufman pointed out this is, I think he said, the only time that it talks about someone blessing the sacrifice. I thought that was kind of interesting. Like you said, we don't know as far as what their relationship right now is with idolatry. We assume it's probably still going on kind of behind the shadows. But it's interesting that they have all of these high places. And if the city here, if Zuf is in Rama, if this is talking about this particular city, I don't remember if it specified which city this was. I don't think it did. But let's assume that it's Rama, since that was where Samuel spent a lot of his time, his hometown. I think in chapter 10 it's going to talk about a couple of other high places, or I think there's one called the Hill of God or something like that. So as opposed to kind of the centralized worship where we're supposed to be, you know, at the tabernacle, we kind of see it spread out a little bit more. Maybe that was Samuel's way, or God through Samuel trying to kind of revitalize the spirituality and get people to start thinking on this spiritual level. Or maybe it's, as you said, maybe it's they're kind of slipping back into that. They're kind of teetering on the edge. I'm a little like Balaam. I'm not sure exactly what it's showing here. It's showing some, but not what it ought to be.
Yeah, one of the things that distinguish you know, God's people and the way they worship from other pagan nations, you know, your Baals, your Molechs, is that they had a tabernacle, right? And that they would all meet in the tabernacle. Well, this is something that's, they're actually, maybe adopting might be too severe, but it's something they have in common with the pagans now, is they go up on a high place to worship. That's where the idols were. They would be up on a high place for various pagan nations. So yeah, I appreciate that. Anyone else on this question? All right, let's move on to question number 4, and this will be for you, Dad, if you want. Or Ramsey, would you like to crack it? All right, yeah, for you, Dad. Question number 4, what did the Lord reveal to Samuel about Saul? Why do the people still need to be saved from the Philistines? And why was Saul perplexed by Samuel's reply to him?
Well, it's a fascinating. We get a little look into how the Lord functioned with the prophets. He spoke literally into Samuel's ear and told him, tomorrow I will send you a man from Benjamin, and you will anoint him commander over my people. And so he tells Samuel, I'm sending you the anointed king, which obviously is an impressive thing. Amos 3:7 says, surely the Lord God does nothing unless he reveals his secret counsel to his servants, the prophets. And it's interesting, he speaks into Samuel's ear the same way Jesus spoke into the ears of the disciples. I just thought about that and was reflecting on how God speaks to those he loves. And this also points out, you know, something has been made of the fact that the servant said, there's a man of God here and there's a prophet here. And we knew that was of God, right? So it has been noted that it wasn't Saul that said that. But God is sending Saul and the servant to Samuel. So it was God that put that in the servant's heart. It wasn't necessarily because Saul was a non-religious guy.
Yeah.
It was God directing them. And so I tend to be a little bit more that Saul at this point is still an innocent and good man. I don't know his heart. But, you know, David obviously had a much more fervent heart for God as a young man, but he still went astray and committed adultery and murder later. So, I don't know. It's very, obviously very difficult to look into someone's heart and know where they're at exactly. Why are the Philistines back? The Philistines are back because the people have asked for a king. Because we're told back in chapter 7 that during all the days of Samuel, the Philistines were subdued and did not come within the border of Israel. But now, because they are asking for a king, the Lord is going to allow the Philistines to come back for a little bit so that Saul can defeat them and then become king. So I think, for me anyway, that's part of God's plan to certify Saul as king. What are the people crying about? It says, God says, I regard my people because their cry has come to me. Is it possible the Philistines were bothering the people? Well, again, 1 Samuel 7:13 says that they weren't during the days of Samuel. Is it the cry of the people for a king that God has regarded, perhaps? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. Maybe there's other opinions. And then the last question is, why was Saul perplexed? Well, here he is. if you accept the fact that he's a humble guy, he is weirding out because here's Samuel, this major important prophet who's like, the desire of Israel is upon you. And come with me, I know everything that's in your heart. And don't worry, the donkeys are safe. You know, he hadn't said anything about the donkeys. Don't worry, the donkeys are safe. And, you know, talk about, he's just out looking for donkeys. And all of a sudden, here's this major prophet saying, you're the next Messiah who's going to appear upon the scene. And so I would like to buy the fact that Saul is still humble. I'm just putting that out as a possibility. And he doesn't particularly want this job. I think, you know, he's not, I didn't ask for this job. I didn't apply, I didn't fill out, you know, an application. So why should I be the person that gets this job? And I'm going to go hide among the baggage, as we see. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, no, I agree. You know, hard to know his heart, right? But I think you could say he didn't want the job, whether it was because, you know, do I really have to do something for the Lord? Why is that my deal? Or, you know, I'm not worthy. Whichever one of those, you know. I think in both cases, he's probably not too fond of the idea. Like we talked about, like Moses was, you know, originally. Perhaps it's something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, the past of the Benjamites may have had something to do with this. You know, they were almost wiped out. There were only 600 men left, as we talked about earlier. Did they nurse a grudge against God? Is it possible that they... you know, of course, the Apostle Paul comes from this tribe too, and is the greatest writer of the New Testament. But maybe at this time they're still sort of nursing, or maybe they were grateful to God that they survived. I don't know. But it's interesting to think about. If there's only 600 of you left, you know, what would your attitude toward God?
Yeah. How do you conduct yourselves when God, you know, keeps you going? Anyone else? Yeah, Eli.
I mean, I appreciate what's been said. Yeah, I've kind of looked at it a little bit here. It's not necessarily the question, but, you know, it's just been kicking around in my head a little bit. I don't think we need to frame the narrative, and I'm not, no disrespect to anything that's been said, but just because Saul is a bad king later on doesn't mean that we need to somehow find some bad thing that he didn't. I don't think the thing with the donkey, I don't know, and again, no disrespect, I'm just throwing it out there, but, you know, there was desperation in that. I forget what the verse says, but it says, come, let us return, lest my father cease caring about the donkeys and become worried about us. And, you know, a lot of times they're used to prophets serving as judges, too, which, you know, deal with secular things. So, I don't know. I don't see any bad attributes, but again, you know, it's just all speculation, so it's not anything to get, you know, wrapped up over
there. Yeah, no, just pure speculation just out of an interest, right? If God wanted us to know it, we'd know it, you know. Yeah, Dakota?
I would like to advocate maybe the additional position that maybe simultaneously multiple of these things are true. Our minds shift and our hearts change as we go through our situation. So maybe, you know, he's kind of like an upper middle class suburbs kid, kind of the way he presented. So he's probably like, whoa, are you sure? Like, that's a job for me. Like, my wife hasn't really required that amount of dedication. So desperation over finding donkeys is obviously important. He's concerned because his dad is probably growing concerned about them. And like, well, this guy's got a reputation for being able to get things done. And, you know, he has abilities that we don't have. So yeah, that sounds like a great idea. Let's go seek his advice.
Yeah, and just another thought I had, I really appreciate that. You know, like all of us, right? You know how busy all of us can get sometimes. And he's over here having a panic attack, going 40 miles for a donkey, right? There's probably some stress there if you're willing to travel 40 miles. So maybe he does have God in his heart more than, you know, we might assume or kick around tonight. But Hunter, you had something to say?
Yeah, I'll hop on this train since everyone else is hopping on. So, yeah, I think it's very easy for us to vilify Paul, or Saul, not Paul. Very easy for us to vilify him because we know the end of the story. I mean, starting out, we were kind of saying, who's a bad guy? But we know what happens, and we don't know his heart here, like you said. I don't know. But it's almost a trope. You know, Gideon says this just a couple chapters back. He says, who am I? Like, Lord, why am I going to do this? And Moses says the same thing, and several other people, I'm pretty sure in Scripture, have said the same thing. Of, why would you choose me? And I think it's more of a confession of humility. But, and I could be wrong, could be some sort of play, but I think it's more coming out of humility or innocence, like Bart said. But I think really, maybe for us to keep in mind, and I could be wrong about this as well, but I think the story of Saul is more a warning of the polluting aspects of power, that he kind of, through his brain, becomes twisted and starts to go down that path, and more of a warning to us in that nature. I could be wrong about that. But I think starting off, Saul seems to have a genuine heart, and then he becomes corrupted. It's sort of a, almost a doubting Thomas sort of thing, like that is preached on before. We vilify Thomas, but I don't really think that's justified.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, can you even imagine the change in his life that occurs, right? I mean, he's coming from his, as Dakota said, upper middle class, you know, suburbanite lifestyle maybe, and now he's a king. It's a completely different, you know, in the ways that would, like, change his mind. I mean, any number of things could happen, right? So I appreciate that. Anyone else before we move on? Yeah, Austin?
No, I think everybody should. No. No, honestly, y'all do make some good points. I think it's very easy to see the end of the story, and I think I can get caught up in that, and also it's comparison. Because you look at Saul, and also because we know David, you know, Saul had to go through a complete transformation of heart. God had to give him a new heart. We find in chapter 10, he didn't have to do that with David. And sometimes you look at that, and by comparison, then we start making our own judgments, and I guess that's why we're not the judge, right? Mm-hmm. But also, to some of the points that have been made, just because maybe he's, whether this is modesty or maybe a little bit of false modesty, whatever it might be, apprehension that he has, he's still someone who's selected, handpicked by God. And there's been a lot of God's servants that have been handpicked that have been apprehensive of taking on that role. So that doesn't make him, it makes him human, I guess is really what it makes it. And that's kind of a tough pill to swallow sometimes.
Yeah. Awesome discussion. I loved all the various ideas that were bouncing around about Saul. All right, looking at time, I guess we should probably move on to question number 5. What's the significance of the portion of food that was held back for Saul? Why were Saul and Samuel speaking on top of a roof? And what might they have been speaking about prior to Saul's anointing? And this will be for you, Landon, if you want.
Yeah, so the significance of the portion of the food that Saul was given. Josephus writes that the Jews identify this meat portion as the royal portion of meat, which should indicate to Saul that, you know, some great events are about to take place, especially considering Samuel's words in verse 20. And Spurgeon writes, "The right shoulder of the animal that was offered in sacrifice was part of the priest's portion, and this shoulder Samuel now ordered the cook to set before Saul as he sat in the place of honor. Essentially, Samuel is showing to Saul that he is preferred among men, and he is destined to have a seat of honor, and he will be elevated to rule." So, essentially, this piece of meat was to show Saul that he's going to be a big deal. For question B, why were they on the top, speaking on the top of the roof? Well, considering that in 1902, Willis Carrier invented the first modern AC, the roof of the house was typically the coolest place you could be. Houses in that day, of ancient Israel, were usually stone blocks with some wood beams, maybe some clay as well. And with multiple people inside, that house would heat up pretty quick. So you'd usually have meetings on top of the roof with people, you know, so you have that breeze blowing. It's a nice, cool place. And it's also a little bit secretive as well. If you're wanting to have a secret conversation away from people, you'd probably go to the roof of the house. For question C, what might they have been speaking about prior to the anointing? Samuel here is probably It says he's announcing the word of God to him. So Samuel was told by God that he's going to make, the man that he meets, he's going to make commander of Israel. So Samuel is telling Saul this information. He's about to be placed in charge of Israel. He's about to take a place of great honor, and it's going to be up to him to lead Israel in the righteous ways. And he's probably telling Saul that, you know, if he does his job correctly, he can bring Israel back to God and hopefully bring peace to the nation.
Yeah, awesome. That's pretty much everything I had, so nice. Anyone else on question number 5? Any additional details? One for a win, maybe? Yeah, Bill.
Leviticus chapter 7, verse 32. Also the right thigh shall give to the priest as a heave offering. 1 Samuel chapter 9, verse 24. So the cook took up the thigh with its upper part. And I read a commentator too that I don't understand how they get shoulder out of this. It says thigh to me, unless there's something in a translation that I'm missing. I wanted to point that out. I thought that was interesting because it's certainly the thigh and the shoulder are two different parts of the animals. We know that. I think that's all we got.
All right, appreciate it. Yeah, we should look into the Hebrew. Maybe I will after the study night. Just look at the Hebrew and compare them, you know, and get maybe a little bit more clarification if you can. Anyone else on question number 5? Talking about air conditioning, perhaps? All right. Well, I think that'll wrap us up for tonight. Really interesting chapter with Saul's donkey quest coming to a conclusion, I guess. That'll wrap us up for tonight's study. We'll reach the gospel invitation. I'd like to extend that.